If you love true crime and dark stories, then you'll love our other podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.
He told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts.
You know, then this guy gets rich and he has some issues with sexual addiction.
Yeah, and control. Yeah. The Keith Raniere story.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and don't miss a single episode.
In some ways, it starts to make things like Jeffrey Dahmer and that look tame, not in terms of the brutality of what they performed, but in terms of the psychology and manipulation of people.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Available wherever you download podcasts.
Your identity is what makes you, you. What happens when someone steals your identity and starts to claim that they are you? What kind of damage can be done? That's what we're talking about today on Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Cautionary Tales. Stories that are passed down or around. But are they always true? Do we really know their true meaning or intent? This is the podcast where we dive into cautionary tales, superstitions, mysteries, and more to discover the truth behind the tale. This is Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Welcome to the show. Don't forget to press the subscribe button. It's me, Harper Brewski, and my dad, Tony Brewski, my co-host. Sorry, I just cannot talk today.
That's fine.
Have you ever gotten your identity stolen?
Me? No, not that I'm aware of. No, I don't believe so. But my mom has. I remember in the 90s, there was something where there was like somebody was trying to open up credit cards or something in Florida, and it was kind of a mess for a little bit, but they got it taken care of and it didn't turn into a huge fiasco. But some people have that happen, and it can be an incredible mess, especially if you don't catch it early on, because if you get your identity stolen, people can go open up bank accounts, get credit cards in your name, can get loans for houses or property or cars or whatever, and you don't find out about it until you start getting the bills that haven't been paid, and they start going, why haven't you paid this? What's going on with this? Like, I didn't do any of this. And that's why you have to check credit reports and everything like that to make sure that nobody has taken your identity. There's one thing where you can steal an identity through what's called your social security number. All of us have this number. It's like our barcode, if you will. If you live in the United States, you have a social security number. And that's a number that basically corresponds and follows you for the rest of your life. And that's your credit, and everything is associated with that. And your credit is based on you paying back loans and money that you borrowed and all of that. And if somebody else starts using that falsely, it can totally screw up what the government associates with being you. And then you have to go back and somehow prove and show that you didn't do these fraudulent things. And that can take sometimes years to get corrected. Another way of stealing an identity is not going to that depth of going and, you know, taking out loans and things of that nature. Sometimes people just take on identities. They just say they're somebody else. Sometimes they get an ID of somebody else and just pretend they are this person and go about their life and do things. Sometimes people like take identities of dead people and go on about their lives. Sometimes people take on identities of dead loved ones if they're not going to get caught, because maybe there's no other family members that are going to notice this or care. It's a crazy world, but people do it. People have taken on many, many different identities over the years, and that's what we're going to talk about today on your show and share many stories of people who've taken on different identities.
Let's jump right in.
First one is the imposter and the disappearance of Nicholas Barclay. In 2012, the documentary The Imposter, it told the story of the disappearance of Nicholas Barclay, a 13-year-old Texas boy who left home on his bike one day and turn up in Spain 3 years later. Except the film's title suggests it wasn't really him. Berkeley did leave his home in San Antonio on June 13, 1994, but was never seen again. When the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received a call from Spain in 1997 saying a boy showed up at a shelter claiming to have escaped a very violent ring, they thought a miraculous recovery may have been made. But the boy claiming to be the 16-year-old Barclay was actually a 23-year-old named Frederick Bourdain, who was a French con artist. The fact that Bourdain wasn't Barclay seemed obvious. He looked nothing like the missing boy and had a French accent. Still, the Barclay family took him in for 6 months before the ruse was uncovered. Why Bourdain did this was unclear, but why the family went along with it could be much more sinister. Bourdain has since claimed that the family killed Barclay and buried him on the property. Coming from a pathological liar, the accusation should come with an Everest-sized grain of salt, but it does make an eerie amount of sense. And I should note that our stories today are coming to us from Ranker.com and a list of all these disappearances. But that is a bizarre one. This idea that this child disappeared all those years ago, and then suddenly he pops up in Spain, and the family just accepts him back as if it were him for 6 months. Now, we're talking about someone who disappeared at the age of what? Thirteen. So when they would have found him, he would have been 16. You would certainly be able to tell the difference between a 16-year-old and a 23-year-old.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's a teen. They have a personality.
Well, that and the fact that, I mean, a 13-year-old, you could look at the 13-year-old version of someone and then see the 23-year-old version of that person and go, okay, that's probably them.
Yeah.
We're talking a 3-year difference here. So how the hell did they
actually believe that it was him?
Yeah. I mean, is this a case simply of a family that is so longing to have their son back? Which I could understand. If your child goes missing, I cannot contemplate this idea. But if you were to go through that and then someone shows up that kind of seems to be like them, but 6 months. I mean, I would think, you know, after a couple minutes or hours, you know, I mean, again, I'm Sunday or Monday morning quarterbacking this. Or backseat driving this. But the thing is, I don't know how you would, unless you're that just kind of delusional and that disturbed from everything that happened, that you're just going to grasp at anything that says that this is your child. The fact that they don't even have, they have a different accent than what the kid had, doesn't even look like the kid. And they're several years older. How do you think that this is your child and go along with it for six? I got to watch this documentary. I'm really curious about how this all went down.
Can I watch it with you?
Yeah.
I'm also very, very curious.
I have not seen this yet, but I'd love to get a better grasp. I'm speaking from someone who just knows about the story from the last couple of paragraphs we talked about. I don't know what on earth they were thinking. And then the guy making the accusation that they killed the kid. And that's where it does make a little bit of sense, where it's like, well, maybe this will be maybe that is the answer. I don't know. Maybe, you know, if we claim that this is our child back, then we'll never get caught. Somehow this has happened to us. And I don't know. I got to watch that documentary to get a better grasp on that.
Me too.
Another one. This is the hit and run death of Suzanne Davis. Frank Delano Floyd has been on death row in Florida since 2002 for the 1989 murder of dancer Cheryl Comesso. In 2014, the Floyd family confessed to another crime that he had long been suspected of, the murder of stepson Michael Anthony Hughes. Floyd married Michael Hughes' mother, a woman and then known as Tanya Hughes, in 1989. Tanya died on a hit-and-run in 1990, and Floyd abandoned Michael. He became a ward of the state and was placed in foster care. In 1994, Floyd decided he wanted custody of Michael, but the state refused to grant it. Floyd was not Michael's biological father, and they had severe doubts about his ability to take care of Michael. So Floyd kidnapped Michael from his elementary school. Floyd was caught, but there was no trace of Michael. In 1995, Floyd was convicted on charges related to kidnapping and sentenced to 52 years in prison. Despite this, Floyd maintained for years that Michael was alive and well. But when Floyd confessed to murdering Michael, he also shed some light on Tanya. Tanya Hughes' real name was Suzanne Marie Savakis. Floyd was married to Savakis' mother in 1975. When Savakis' mother went to jail for a petty crime, she served only 30 days. Floyd took off with Savakis. She was 6 years old at the time. Floyd and Savakis lived on the run for the rest of her life. They married in 1989 before she died in 1990. Floyd is also considered a suspect in Savakis' death. So this is a case where the guy marries the daughter? Is that what I'm getting out of this?
Because it almost like... Because what I heard is that this man took a six-year-old and then...
Yeah. And then as she grew up, then eventually married her. I guess kind of brainwashed her as she grew up and then said, you're going to be my wife or some craziness like that. It's just disturbing what human beings are capable of.
It is very disturbing. I mean, like, this is a grown adult. Adult that's kidnapping a six-year-old and then later on marries her?
And it makes you wonder what his motives were.
And why?
For that, and also trying to get custody of that the son of the other woman that then disappeared. What was that motive? Was it to get his identity as well, or that never happened? I don't know. It's utterly bizarre. Here's a chameleon killer. Elaine Parnett, the chameleon killer, was a con woman who killed her roommate Beverly McGowan in 1990. McGowan was found on a central bank in southern was found on a central bank in southern Florida. Her head and hands removed by a chainsaw, and her stomach tattooed and sliced at her torso. The parent had moved in with McGowan, or Parnett rather, had moved in with McGowan just 72 hours prior to the murder under the guise that she was an English employee of IBM. In truth, Parnett was born in the Bronx in 1942. She quickly fled to Britain after McGowan's murder, purchasing a plane ticket with her victim's credit card. Over the next 12 years, Parnett was pursued by UK and American authorities. She was spotted in London, Paris, Turkey, Australia, and South Africa along the way. Parnett used over 20 different aliases and hid out with a variety of lovers in Europe and the U.S. And then in 1998, she taunted Florida authorities by mailing them an oil painting of herself with the words, "Best wishes, your chameleon," typed on the back. When law enforcement finally closed in on Parnett in 2002, she fatally shot herself. An advanced psychopathic criminal, she's believed to have killed several victims, though her body count remains a mystery to this day.
Okay, this is another disturbing one.
Yeah.
Very disturbing.
Someone who goes around, it was like a game to her. People's lives were a game to her. It's someone like that, the only way that one who is not that mentally ill and disturbed to try and understand the psyche and the thinking of someone is they have to believe that they are the only person on the planet and that everyone else is really not there or not part of it. It doesn't have feelings, doesn't have emotions, and everything revolves around them. It's like the ultimate narcissism. I don't understand how anyone could go about their life and do these things in any way
without just not having emotions.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the only way I think one could process that sort of thing and go on with that, to a point of making it into a game and sending an oil painting to the police.
It's like Pac-Man to her.
It really kind of was.
Because, like, the dots are the people, and she's murdering the people.
And she's going around, and they're being chased.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very much catch me if you can, or as you put it, Pac-Man. It's, yeah, it's that's a way of analogizing that. Here's one. In 2001, Russian ex-surgeon Dmitry Yezilov was sentenced to 30 years in prison for the murders of Irina Melizik and Viktor Axelyev. I'm horrible at saying Russian names. I'm sorry. That's my best. They lived and worked in New Jersey and knew both of his victims. The crimes themselves were brutal. Yezilov left a trail of dismembered body parts along with really creepy Dracula masks. They were discovered in 2006 in the New Jersey woods. Just got to go get that Dracula mask when you're killing people.
It makes sense because, like, you said the name almost like blah, 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 blah.
Oh, like...
And then the next part was really creepy Dracula masks.
You're making the reference to...
Hotel Transylvania.
Yes. Blah, 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 blah. Yeah. That's true. That kind of worked out well.
Very well.
Yakilov's motive was clear. After the murders, he immediately began using the victims' identities. So he killed them to use their identities. Going on lavish shopping sprees with his wife, using the deceased's credit cards. But that's not a smart way to get away with murder. And Yakilov was caught pretty quick. Authorities suspect that the serial killer was involved in the 2003 disappearance of former NYPD mechanic Michael Klein, an associate of Yakilov, and purchased a home from Klein. And shortly thereafter, he vanished without a trace. However, Yakilov wasn't charged with that crime. So there's one with someone who thought, hey, if I get rid of these people, I can get their information and their cards, and I can go shopping. And he did. And he got caught. And that is not a way for that to work out well.
Of course not.
Just watch Home Alone 2 and you'll know that using even your father's credit card for unscrupulous purchases will eventually get you caught.
Yeah.
You got to be careful with that.
Because, like, you have that person's information, and if you're a completely different age and their credit card's like that exact age, it's like, no, you're not that person.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, so often when you use a credit card, I mean, depending on what you're buying, I mean, if you're buying like a major, major purchase, they will ID you and they'll go, can I see your ID? Because they don't want to be on the hook for it. But so many times I use my credit card and I'll make, you know, fairly large purchases, several hundred dollars at a pop. And it's rare that I get asked for an ID. It really is. And the thing is, credit card companies are then on the hook for that. If someone were to steal my credit card and go use it and do that, they could go get to buy a lot of stuff. Eventually, it would be stopped. But the thing is, if you get out of there with that merchandise, it's gone. And that's why, I mean, credit cards are just it's a weird system. It's something that, you know, kind of worked well for a while. It still does work, but the fraud end of it, unless we start enforcing the ID portion of credit cards better than we do, it will continue to be a massive, massive problem. And that's why there's billions of dollars in credit card fraud every single year. It needs to go beyond just the, can I see the signature on the back of your card? Okay, that must be your signature. Or can I see your ID? Okay. And they barely look at it. Like, oh, says your name there. Like, I could have printed that off. I mean, there's a lot of ways you could get away with that, which is scary. And the thing is, a lot of people do. I had a credit card stolen once and they got away. They probably charged more than $10,000 in gift cards. They went to a Walmart and bought more than $10,000 in gift cards. And guess what? The Walmart sold it to them. And they never checked the ID, never did anything like that. And you know who ended up being on the line for it? The credit card company. Because it was never checked. And the store never checked. And that's why you get credit cards that also have fraud identity fraud protection on them. So if that does happen, you're not then liable because there's some cards that do put you liable if it gets stolen. But that's where you don't catch it because they know they got to go buy that stuff quick before you catch it. And then, you know, it'll get stopped. But if you walk out of that store with all those gift cards or whatnot, they're on the street. They're going to be used. But that's what can happen. Here's one. On the evening of Christmas Eve 2010, Lori Erica Ruff committed suicide in the driveway of her Texas home. The wife and mother had become increasingly erratic in the months leading up to her death, and she was facing divorce proceedings that seemed to have broken her. It was a tragic ending, and it would ultimately leave many more questions than answers. After Lori's funeral, widower Blake Ruff opened a lunchbox that his wife had previously forbidden him from touching. In it, he found an Idaho ID with Lori's image, but bearing the name Becky Sue Turner. It came with a matching birth certificate. A private investigator later discovered that Becky Sue Turner had died at 2 years old in the state of Washington. Soon, everything Blake knew about his life or his late wife unraveled. Her upbringing in Arizona was false. Authorities got involved in an effort to learn the woman's true identity. Was she hiding from a terrible crime? Just who was Lori Erica Ruff? The official investigation never uncovered the truth.
Behind the secret, and that's...
So this woman got married, had a family, and she had this whole other identity. No one knew who she was. Why did she have this background? Who were these people? What was this other identity? What was going on? And there's no one there than to ever answer that question.
It just makes you think, what is going on in these people's minds that just make them, like, literally steal someone else's identity? It's just like, why? Why would you do that?
At a very surface level, it would be fight or flight. And a lot of times flight and then fight to a certain extent. But it's survival. And if you come from a very messed up background, sometimes from a very young age, that's what you learn and that's all that you know. And it never gets corrected. It never gets changed, no matter how many stable, well-meaning people are in your life, no matter how much you can kind of chameleon yourself to be part of those environments, to look normal. What's going on in the mind of people like that is still not good and not healthy and not well. And sometimes people can recover from those sort of things and learn to live a healthy life, but there's always going to be an element of the damage and the trauma that was done to them. And sometimes that damage and trauma is so extreme that they so want to live a normal life, but they cannot ever achieve it because of the damage that was done and them unable to get the help that they need, or it just not being there because you would unearth too many things to ever get through to it. So it's always interesting to try and understand the stories of people like that. And with a case like that, we don't have the full story. But it's something where you can never just write it off going, well, they're freaking crazy. There's an element of that, yes. But with anyone that's freaking crazy, there is a deeper story. Why is that person acting in the way that we would describe as freaking crazy?
Okay, please just stop using that voice.
But that's how it gets so callously kind of thrown around. And there's a story there. And the more that we can try to understand those sort of things, the more likely that people who are suffering truly can get help that they need. Here's another one. In July of 2002, Joseph Newton Chandler put a gun in his mouth and he killed himself. In Eastlake, Ohio, the Eastlake, Ohio man had been battling colon cancer and decided enough was enough. It's sad, if not an uncommon story, save for one detail. It wasn't the first time he died. the real Chandler, an eight-year-old boy, had previously died in a car crash in Texas in 1945. The man who claimed his identity did so in 1978 by filing a Social Security card in South Dakota. He then moved to California and then later to Cleveland. After his death, the faux Chandler left little behind other than $82,000 in the bank, leading authorities to believe he was some sort of fugitive. Some amateur detectives have even pinned Chandler as possibly being the Zodiac Killer. The connection is based on nothing more than conjecture. His true identity remains a mystery. So this guy goes for almost all of his adult life as being someone else.
That died in a car crash as a little boy.
And eventually he ends his own life because of the pain he was going through with cancer. But it makes you wonder why did he have to claim an identity that wasn't his? And there could be a lot of answers to that question. It could be something where he's
freaking crazy.
No, it could be something very simple and really not nefarious. It could be something where he was born, not in a hospital, his family was messed up, never even registered as being a human being or alive. No social security number, no nothing. He's just kind of there. And it was presented to him at some point in life of, I can clearly get this identity and no one will know about it. I just want to move on with my life and live a normal life. I'm going to do this. I'm not going to hurt anyone. This child's already dead. But if I claim the identity, then I can live a normal life. I'm not going to harm anyone in the process. And really, from what we know about this case, he really did not harm anyone in that process. It could be something very simple like that. And that was what he thought was the simple way of living a normal life. I mean, there are other ways that could have been done, but that might have just been the path of least resistance for him at the time. But I can't imagine the family and friends of that person. You know, you put those pieces together and you just end up with so many questions. When someone dies, you end up having questions that you wish you would have asked them when they were alive, regardless if it's someone that's close to you. It's just the nature of life and death. But to have something like that where you open the shoebox up and it's like, oh my God, who was this person? And your mind will automatically go to pretty dark things, you know, Zodiac Killer, this or that, or just he wanted to live a life and this was the path that he thought was appropriate in 1978. Doesn't make it right, but it may not have been as nefarious as one thought. I don't know. I don't know much more about that case other than what we just read. Here's one. Dr. Shana Ann Phelps left her New York City apartment on September 10th, 2001 and was never seen again. On the morning of September 11th, her husband, Ron Lieberman, had not yet heard from her, but he wasn't worried. It was not unlike Philip to spend the night away with family. But when the terror attacks happened and he could still not reach his wife, he began to fear the worst. Lieberman hired a private investigator and later concluded that Philip had likely rushed to the World Trade Center to assist with any victims. It's an altruistic and view of her tragic death that Lieberman painted, but it may have been far from the truth. In reality, the two have been having marital problems, reported to have taken on a serious drinking habit. Philip seemed to be avoiding her husband at all costs. Though she was officially ruled dead in 2008, nothing has ever tied her to the tower attacks. And some speculate that she used the tragedy as an opportunity to start a new life. That she was tied into the September 11th attacks and maybe she disappeared and became someone else. Make me wonder if something else happened with the relationship there and that the death was tied to that and as a convenient excuse. I don't know.
What exactly is that? What was the terror attacks that you were just talking about?
The September 11th terror attacks. World Trade Center, 9/11.
Oh, 9/11.
Yes, 2001. You're used to, yeah. Welcome to the world of 2021, everyone. You're used to me saying 9/11, September 11th is also, yeah. So it was looked at as possibly her being killed there. But she may have just disappeared and started a new life. Who knows? Maybe she has another identity somewhere else to this day. Almost like the last story of the other guy where he's like, maybe this is why he took on a different identity. I don't know. There's another interesting story. I don't have it here in front of me, but there was one where tying into 9/11, where a woman claimed to be in the towers, claimed to have escaped the towers. And there's a whole documentary on this. And she did it to get credit, essentially, to get pity from people that, oh my gosh, you're a survivor. And it was a pretty harrowing thing if you did survive that day and survived getting out of those towers. But to then make up that you were in the building and have this whole BS story that you're telling your friends and family in the media, it turns out you weren't even there. So that it wasn't necessarily a different identity, but a totally different path of reality that she was on. And that was a disturbing story. And it just makes you wonder, how does someone live their life with that? I mean, it's like people claiming they were, you know, war heroes or something like that when they weren't even in a war. But people do that. People do crazy things like that for attention.
And just take credit.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know that feeling when you lie to someone and it just, like, sticks there and you just do not like it?
Sure, that's what healthy, normal people feel. Yes. I'm glad you feel that. Yeah. I don't know. The only thing I could say is someone who's able to do that doesn't have that sticky feeling. It's just not there. And that's what allows them to do something like that. That's the only way I can contemplate it.
And then if you don't have that feeling, you are not human.
No, they are. But there's something that's not right with them as human beings. I'm glad we have those feelings. I don't think I would want to be a person. The scary things that you could end up getting involved with if you didn't have that feeling is quite terrifying, I think. I'd much rather be someone. I mean, yeah, you could get away with a lot of stuff, but I would just think the out of control possibilities are far scarier than, I guess, not feeling that shame or guilt that comes along with lying.
That wraps up today's episode. Be sure to press the subscribe button wherever you download podcasts and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you don't ask the right questions, you might end up being part of a cautionary tale. For Cautionary Tales with Harper, I'm Harper Bruski.